Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. We're delighted you're all here. I must say I am delighted and amazed at the turnout this afternoon, but in no small measure it's a tribute to the friendship and the honor that the ambassador's colleagues have for him. Ambassador, welcome, and you really produced a very good audience. For your prime minister. And, of course, this is going to be a very interesting session. We're looking forward to this very much. For a United States of America that's having a hard time keeping itself together, we're really looking forward to what the United States of Europe is going to be like. Prime Minister, this is a remarkable book you've written, and it's really captured a sentiment, I think, for the time and the spirit. And we're really pleased to hear you here today. Prime Minister Verhofstadt has this remarkable history. We have one adjective that's now thrown around far too loosely in Washington is transformational. And it's an adjective that is attached to virtually any noun. But I must say, in looking back over history, you have been truly a transformational figure in Belgian politics. And it's remarkable what you've accomplished during your tenure, Prime Minister. And I know that you now have a larger vision which you're sharing with the world. I hope you'll do both today. I hope that you will share with us not only your vision for the way in which you are transforming Belgium, but also what it could mean in a larger sense for Europe. And it's a great privilege to have you here. Franz, I really do thank you. You've been a great friend at CSIS, and obviously the enormous respect and esteem that your colleagues and we all have for you here has contributed to this afternoon. We're very grateful that you gave us this opportunity. Prime Minister, we need to hear from you. Thank you for coming. We're delighted you're here.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much to your organization, CSIC, for the opportunity to give this speech this afternoon here in Washington. And Europe's dream of conducting, ladies and gentlemen, a unified policy has been around for quite some time. And I'm naturally not talking about the imperialistic plans for unification hatched by Charlemagne or Napoleon, or any nostalgic dream of the re-establishment of the Roman Empire, or a Christian Europe ruled by some emperor. On the contrary, what I mean is the democratic dream, the democratic dream of a United States of Europe, as invoked by such great Europeans as Victor Hugo and Winston Churchill. And yet I have to tell you that the first person to have this dream was in fact not European, but American. And no ordinary American, but George Washington himself. Over 200 years ago, in a letter to his European friend, the Marquis of Lafayette, Washington wrote, and I quote, "I am a citizen of the greatest republic of mankind. I see the human race united like a huge family by brotherly ties. We have made a sowing of liberty which will little by little spring up across the whole world, and one day, on the model of the United States of America, a United States of Europe will come into being. The United States of Europe will legislate for all its nationalities." End of quote. So 2 centuries later, it has become clear that this comparison between America and Europe was an inspired vision. Indeed, the similarity between the historical development of both continents is, I think, striking and more extensive than most people might imagine. A similar debate and discussion to the one currently going on in Europe took place, in fact, in North America in the late 18th century, when America's constituent states joined together to form a federal state, the United States, to which they ceded significant powers. And what's more, federal America gradually expanded from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and the parallel is striking. Not only are the EU member states assigning more and more powers to the European Union, but the Union is expanding from the Atlantic Ocean towards the Urals. And the more I read about American history, the more similarities I find. So following the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War in 1775, the 13 new independent states that had formerly been British colonies formalized their cooperation, and adopting the Articles of Confederation in 1781, they formally created a union that had already been informally established during their struggle for independence. And those Articles of Confederation created the United States of America, which did not have a government, but did have a Continental Congress in which each of these 13 states had one vote. And the Union at that moment was weak, and the Articles of Confederation allowed states to leave the Confederation if they felt that their freedom and sovereignty were threatened. And moreover, articles could only be amended by unanimous agreement between all the members of the Union at that time. And during the early years of the Articles, various attempts were made to give the Union more power, since discord had arisen between the states on how to regulate and tax foreign trade. And yet all these attempts failed due to a lack of consensus, and a few important amendments were even defeated following their opposition by a single state. And this situation, as we know, irritated the first group of Americans led by James Madison, who became better known as the Federalists, and in the end the Federalists managed to convince Congress to arrange a convention to improve the Articles of Confederation. And that became the Philadelphia Convention. At the Philadelphia Convention of 1787, the Federalists drew up a completely new constitution under which the Union had far greater powers. And one article proved particularly important in this process, because in contrast to the unanimity required under the Articles of Confederation, Article 7 stipulated that approval by 9 of the 13 states was sufficient to approve the Constitution and bring it into force. All this greatly, as we know, displeased the Federalist opponents, the Anti-Federalists, who opposed the Constitution for a variety of reasons, and the main ones were fear of the power wielded by a strong central government, and of course the surrendering of power by the states themselves. And given the influence wielded by the Anti-Federalists, convincing America's citizens to embrace the Constitution was no easy task. So it's in fact, ladies and gentlemen, hardly surprising that in a number of states the ballot was touch and go. But nevertheless, 12 of the 13 states ratified it, and ultimately the only state to have voted against, Rhode Island, which had something of a reputation of a rogue state at that moment, had no choice but to organize a second vote, and then afterwards to join the Union in 1790. However, for I think nearly a century, the United States was in many respects, and despite the Constitution who came out of the Philadelphia Convention, was governed as a confederation in which the individual states had far greater powers than the federal government. And the federal government was especially weak during that period. In fact, it had hardly any departments, and the president had no staff, and the biggest federal department in the 19th century was the Postal Service at that moment. So I think for federal America, the turning point was a civil war, after which the federal government gradually developed, and as individual states proved to be too small for some business initiatives, the opening up of the Far West, the development also of the country's railways and the advent of heavy industry played as critical a role in the government's development as the Constitution itself. In the 1950s, 17% of America's GDP went to the federal government, and now the figure, I think, turns around 20%. But in 1929, however, the year of the massive global economic crash, the federal government received only 1% of America's GDP. So I can tell you, the financial resources of the European Union today are exactly the same, 1% of our GDP. And these are also clear similarities between the American and European discussion on the Constitution. Some European countries have the same fear of abolishing the principle of unanimity and ceding power and autonomy to a more centralized government. And I think another point in common, unfortunately, was that it took a war to prompt unification and an economic crisis to prompt the realization that joining forces was the only way out of the situation. Although I believe we shouldn't try to extend the similarities too far, but I am also convinced that history teaches us that the further unification of Europe is the right road to take, even if sometimes it proves to be a difficult path, as it is the case today. Indeed, the difficulties we face sometimes make people forget that, in fact, so far Europe's unification has been a very successful undertaking. For generations, the unification of Europe has been held up as a major ideal marking an end to constant wars on the old continent, clashes that we could now call European civil wars. And moreover, on the ruins left by two world wars, Europe built durable democracy, prosperity, and I think also a decent level of social cohesion and social protection. And when France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg signed the Treaty of Rome in 1957, they had a specific objective in mind: to develop a close-knit community and form a union capable of guaranteeing peace and prosperity. And right from the outset, the project of European unification proved highly attractive. People from all over Europe wanted to be part of a united continent, especially those enduring military dictatorships like the Greeks, the Spanish, the Portuguese. In fact, it was, I think, partly thanks to the ideal of a united Europe that they, these peoples, found the strength to embark on the road to democracy and cast off dictatorship once and for all. Consequently, I think it's fair to say that the European Union has been a factor in turning poor dictatorships into prosperous democracies. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the dream of a united Europe genuinely lay within reach. And back in 1989, nobody doubted the need for the lost sons and daughters in Eastern Europe to rejoin the European family as soon as possible. And that just what happened, in fact, 15 years later, on the 1st of May of 2004, when, as you know, 8 former Eastern Bloc countries, plus Cyprus and Malta, joined the European Union. And so I think we can say that membership of the European Union remains an attractive proposition, and even now a number of countries, as we know, are knocking on the door of the European Union. But 1 year later, in spring 2005, the constitutional treaty designed to lay fresh foundations for the enlarged Europe was due to be ratified by the member states. And that constitution, European constitution, would constitute an important step for Europe towards the establishment of a federation with an own president, with an own foreign policy, own a single army, and so on. As we know, as you know, in spring 2005, the treaty was rejected in referendums held in both in France and in the Netherlands, two of the founding fathers of the European Union, and the $1 million question currently being asked throughout Europe is today, where do we go from here? From that point of rejection of in both referendums of the Constitution. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, that there are, in fact, several options. The first option is the status quo option. This would entail that we would simply continue without the Constitution. And in fact, it is easy to do. We would then work solely on the basis of previously concluded agreements. But in that option, we continue with a system in which each member state has a right of veto in the key questions. And it makes decision-making difficult for a union comprising 12 countries, even more difficult for a union of 15 member states, and I think as good as unworkable for a union of 25 members, and certainly in the future, when we further enlarge the European Union. And this once became very clear in the negotiations on the European budget last year, in June and in December. A second alternative will be the pick-and-choose option, I should say. So the Constitution would be scrapped, but we would salvage a few elements. But the problem, naturally, with this option is that everyone would like to salvage something different. And so giving everyone what they want would be tantamount to adopting the recently rejected Constitution in its entirety. So we have maybe a third option. The third option is the wait-and-see option, sometimes popular in political circles, like we know. And this would involve simply going ahead with the Constitution's ratification, seeing where this takes us. It happens to be the Union's current approach. Maybe it is an honorable option because it will entail every country be given a chance to say its piece. But at the same time, however, we must bear in mind that a number of countries have already abandoned their referendum, so that all we can do is wait and see what happens. The fourth option is the rollback approach. In other words, to conclude from the no votes in the two referendums that people want less Europe, and that union should therefore be scaled back to become a mere free trade area. My personal view is that none of these options are the right way to go, and instead I'm advocating a fifth avenue. I'm convinced that Europe can learn a great deal from the history of the United States, from your country's response to key economic developments. The United States saw that closer cooperation, enhanced cooperation, was the only viable option to face huge economic challenges as the stock market crash of 1929. And that is why I too am convinced that the challenges today, economic challenges today, at this crucial moment, leave Europe with just one real option, and that is the option of the United States of Europe. In our globalizing economy, new rivals are emerging in the East, where for the moment major centers of development like China and India are undergoing unprecedented transformation. And indeed, within just a few years, Asia has shifted the focus of the world economy. And this development looks certain to gain further impetus in the future. There is no doubt about. And after all, in some parts of Southeast Asia, the economy is at this moment growing 10 times as fast as it is in Europe. And many people feel concerned that these new economic heavyweights are more and more influencing our economy. The price of our oil, for instance, but later on also our political life, and maybe also our military approaches. Economic growth in China, in India, in Japan, in total 2.5 billion people, will change the world as we know it today. That's very certain. And this is the natural run of things. And various European countries, including my country, including Belgium, have already understood this and are busily implementing appropriate reforms. So I can tell you that only a few months ago, we decided to embark on a fundamental reform of our labor market and early pension systems. And by adopting a whole package of measures, we intend to get more people to work and also allow them to work longer than today. And to this end, we have once again also lowered the tax paid on labor. And at the same time, we are also investing more in research and development. We have slashed red tape and lowered also corporate tax. And that is, in fact, also the reason why I'm here in the United States, to promote these new incentives we have adopted in a bid to make investing in Belgium highly attractive. Well, I can tell you that with similar reforms, European countries are pumping new life into their economies. But I think that these efforts alone won't be sufficient. Won't be sufficient because what Europe really needs is a genuine European economic strategy. We must establish common social economic policies. We have one currency, we have one monetary union, but we have none common economic and social strategy. We must work towards the convergence, at least, of rules governing fiscal and social security matters, and we must also develop a common research and development strategy to make Europe far more competitive. However, this new phase of European integration cannot merely include a common socio-economic strategy. We need also a single European area of justice and security. And we must also be capable of tackling crime, terrorism, illegal immigration. And a new Europe should also have a real common foreign policy to prevent the Union from being divided as it was over going to war in Iraq, and prevent the kind of indecision that, ladies and gentlemen, existed when there was a civil war in the former Yugoslavia, a war fought on our own continent. And we are still grateful for the help provided by the United States. But as a union, we should have been ashamed for that. So that is why in future we must have a European army, not just on paper, but one that can actually operate in the field, including beyond our borders. And the philosophy behind all these proposals, all these ideas, is in fact the same. I'm convinced that citizens' doubts and uncertainty, as reflected in the referendums on the European Constitution, are actually a plea for more Europe, for a stronger Europe in any way. The French and the Dutch didn't vote, in fact, against the European Constitution because they are opposed to Europe or want, in fact, less Europe. They voted no because today's Europe doesn't provide the right answers to their real concerns. So, consequently, I'm advocating a stronger Europe, a more closely integrated Europe. I'm advocating, in fact, a powerful Europe that pursues a common economic strategy, a Europe that takes a joint stance against crime, drugs, terrorism, and also a Europe that speaks abroad with one voice. In short, I'm advocating a United States of Europe. And I hope that in the future that all the Union's member states should take part. But if this proves impossible, at least all the countries belonging to the Eurozone should be mobilized, because then in such a scenario, Europe will comprise two concentric circles, a political core, United States of Europe, based on the Eurozone and new members of the Eurozone, new member states that have entered in the European Union, and surrounding it a confederation of countries or organization of European states competent to keep the stability and the peace on the broader European continent. Naturally, The political core, the inner circle, must never oppose any form of broader cooperation. All countries that wish to join this core, whether old or new member states, should be able to do so. The sole precondition should be their willingness to work on pressing ahead with the overall political project. So, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the questions I often hear from Americans are, should we fear this European evolution? Is Europe planning to weaken the Atlantic alliance with such ideas? Does Europe want to become an independent superpower? On the contrary, I think that only a unified Europe can be a long-term and reliable ally of your country, of the United States. It is, in fact, a choice between the disjoint efforts of 25 small states or a single solid partner on which to build. And as we did with the European arrest warrant, for example, after 9/11, making our fight against terror more efficient. Well, I can tell you the same applies in other areas, including military cooperation. A common European defense policy, I think, makes the North Atlantic Alliance stronger and in any way more efficient. And in this globalized world, only, I think, the United States and a unified Europe together will have the authority and the possibilities to defend their values worldwide. So, our transatlantic alliance, however, is not only about cooperating with each other. I think it's also about better understanding each other. And on this point, there is still lots of work. Exactly 1 year ago, I proposed to organize the transatlantic GIMNIC, which is like the European GIMNIC, an informal meeting of the ministers of foreign affairs, both organizations, NATO and the European Union. And President Bush liked the idea, which is why now, 1 year later, already two transatlantic GIMNICs have successfully been organized. One in September in New York, another later on in Brussels in December, after the interministerial meeting of NATO. And I think now we should go one step further and make the field of transatlantic contacts broader. The German Marshall Fund is organizing shortly the Brussels Forum, an informal but high-level weekend meeting between Americans and Europeans. And I can tell you that as Belgian government, we fully do support this new and promising transatlantic initiative. So, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, George Washington predicted that one day the quarrelsome European nations would form a United States of Europe. And at a time, no doubt, nobody believed him. But the founder of the European Union believed him. That was Jean Monnet, who visited the United States before launching his European project at the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s. And in challenging times, the United States of America has opted in favor of closer cooperation. And having done so, not only did it survive, but it flourished as never before. So I think in today's global world, all Europe has to do is to follow the same path and strive to establish a United States of Europe. It was Bernard Shaw who once said, we learn from history, that we learn nothing from history. Well, this time, I feel sure this won't be the case. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. Certainly a powerful vision for a Europe that perhaps appears somewhat adrift at the moment, and certainly an alternative to the wait-and-see approach, which, as you noted earlier, perhaps won't be one of the more effective options. We have very limited amount of time, unfortunately, to be able to do some questions and answers, but we do have the chance to do them. The Prime Minister must leave at 5 to 5. I would like to open it up to the floor. If you are going to ask a question, please try to make it a short question rather than a statement. And do let us know who you are and where you're from. There are people here with microphones walking around the corner. And perhaps let me open it up right now. And if I don't see any hands, I can see two couple opening up over there. Mr. Prime Minister, I'll let you take from the podium. Martin, I can see the. I think that's you. I see the glasses.
Yes, Prime Minister. Martin Walker from United Press International. You suggested that your interpretation of the referendum votes in the Netherlands and in France was that people were not being hostile to Europe, but were wanting more Europe, a stronger Europe that could defend them against the challenges of globalization and so on. What evidence can you bring forward to reinforce that view, particularly in the light of the last Eurobarometer opinion poll, which suggested that more and more Europeans are telling pollsters that they're not sure that EU membership is in their country's interest?
Well, first of all, I think that what happened was that people were anxious from the Polish plumber coming in and their economy, and from the Chinese textile coming on their market. And what they have expressed is that they find that bureaucratic European Union is not the right answer to their concerns and to these challenges. But it's very clear that if people are anxious for globalization, because what I'm talking about is globalization, the answer to their anxiety is not less Europe, but more and closer European cooperation. That's the best answer you can give to globalization. And you see that also you are talking about the Eurobarometer, but in the Eurobarometer you even see the last poll more opinions in favor for the moment for the European Constitution, and still a very positive feeling and opinion of the European public opinion towards closer European integration. And I give one example: European defense. There is already every year in every Eurobarometer we see an enormous majority, a 2/3 majority of the European public opinion in favor of closer European defense initiatives. Even in Great Britain. In Great Britain, in the Eurobarometer of Great Britain, there is a majority. They are maybe against the euro, and they want to keep the pound, okay? But reality is that on, for example, European defense, and there are other examples to give, for example, a common asylum policy, migration policy, security policy, justice policy, there are an enormous majority that you can find, even in countries like, for example, Great Britain. So I think that that we have to make a good analysis of the outcome of the referendum. The outcome of the referendum in France, for example, was not that everybody voted against. There were certainly people who voted against Europe, nationalists, sovereignists, who were against this framework and against European integration. But another part of the French population voted against the European Constitution because they find that the European Constitution is not the right answer to their will to have a closer European economic and social policy. And it's normal, too. People are anxious for what's happening with the Polish plumber and with the Chinese textile, and they don't see a common answer of the European institutions to these challenges. The only thing they see is a European Union that tries to find and to harmonize the opening times of the shops in Europe, where naturally there are enormous different in traditions and also in climate conditions in Europe. So I think the time is right now to start again this discussion of European integration. We started in Europe with a reflection period after the failure in the Netherlands and France, and I feel that this reflection period is more or less a Spanish siesta for the moment in Europe. And I have always thought that the reflection period is a period in which your brains are working and not are sleeping. And that's the reason why I have written this book, The United States of Europe, as a beginning of a new discussion, that the direction of history is very clear. And the direction of history is enhanced and closer cooperation inside the European Union and not going back into one or other free market zone with some intergovernmental cooperation on a number of limited issues like agriculture policy, for example.
Gentleman there, yes, please.
Mr. Prime Minister, you made no mention of a single market in services, although that was part of the European vision even from 1957. Given the importance of services in any future economic growth, the previous European Commission came forward with a very progressive proposal for fulfilling that vision of a single market in services, and yet it was watered down, opposed, delayed by a whole range of European governments, including many that were trying to foist this enormous new constitution on the European public. When can those of us in Washington who actually support the European project and would like to see it come to fruition actually see some real progress on an integrated market in services?
Certainly, for the moment, the European Parliament is discussing the directive that has been put forward by the former European Commission. And it's very clear that they shall propose a number of amendments that shall be discussed again in the European Council, I think, in the next months. And we shall find a compromise on it. It shall not be the initial proposal of Mr. Bolkestein, who was the former commissioner competent for that area, but it shall be an amended proposal in which we take into account a number of existing situations inside the European Union. There is no doubt that we shall have a directive on services. Only it shall be amended towards the first proposals. But I can give you a whole list of things we have to do in the next years. One of the most important for me is to create the European brevet, the European patent. European patent, we are already waiting, I think, more than 10 years for it, for the European patent, if not more than 10 years. And I hope that one of the things we can realize the fastest as possible is European patent that creates an internal market on research and development instead of what we have today. The same with what we have created now, the European company that we have now. So most of the countries are now transposing this directive in internal law. I remember that I was at the university, it was a long time ago, already more than 30 years ago, and at that moment my professor of European legislation law, Mr. Schrans, Professor Schrans, said, okay, we are working on the European company. If you start your career as lawyer, you shall see that shall be the standard now. And it has taken 30 years before we got this European company as a possibility to create a company with the same statutes, under the same conditions in every country of the European Union. So I know we are facing a number of obstacles, but what I fear for the moment is that the rejection of the Constitution in the Netherlands and in France is the starting point of a period in which we don't continue this process of European integration. And that is maybe the worst option, certainly, to take. But the Service Directive is certainly one of these things we shall realize in the year 2006, I think.
Mr. Prime Minister, let me take the privilege of the... I'll come to you in a second. Let me take the privilege of the Chair for the second on one question. You mentioned the common foreign policy would prevent the EU from being divided. I think you compared it to Bosnia and to Iraq. I think the case could also be made that an EU that is less divided is a prerequisite for a common foreign policy. in your opinion, is the EU, are its member states coming together in their outlook and their perspectives on the challenges on the world stage, or in the ways the EU is still too divided on certain aspects of foreign policy to be able to have a common foreign policy?
I'm always thinking that you have, first of all, to create the instruments. And if you have the instruments, you're obliged to have a common point of view. If you have one European diplomacy, if you have one European army, not independent, but as one of the pillars of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, then you are obliged to have a common point of view on a number of issues, because you have your common instrument. And you have to know, shall I activate it, this instrument? Yes or no? In what conditions? Shall I prefer diplomacy? Shall I prefer to engage my military forces? And that's only possible if you have that instrument. I don't believe in common foreign policy in the European Union if we not have, first of all, created these two instruments. I said it based a little bit on the experience I have discussed inside European Council, Iraq, for example. I remember me that it was under the Spanish presidency. I think it was in Barcelona or in Sevilla. I don't remember. It was warm in any way. I think it was in Barcelona. And at that moment, I put forward to the presidency, to Mr. Aznar, is not necessary to, it was, I think, 1 year. 10 months. June 2002. And my request to the European Council was to discuss this, to say, what is our common point of view in Iraq? And the reaction of the President of the Council and of Mr. Blair and of Mr. Chirac was, no, don't start with that. We have not the same point of view. We shall not spend our time to discuss this here in the Council. So the discussion on Iraq before the start of the war in Iraq, 2 minutes. Afterwards, we have discussed a lot of things about that. To say, okay, we have not the same point of view. How is this possible? It's possible that you have not the same point of view if you refuse to discuss it before. And I can give other examples. And I think always that if you create the necessary instruments, then you have the obligation to have a common point of view, because you have to take together the responsibility to engage them or not to engage them.
Thank you. That's definitely a clear answer. So the gentleman waiting there.
My name is Ron from the Netherlands. I thank you very much for your vision, which I think is very appealing. You say that European citizens want a stronger Europe, but don't you think they also want to have a more democratic Europe? And that was also part, at least, of the debate in the Netherlands. And if so, what to do about that?
I think that first answers to have a more democratic Europe were put in the Constitution. Because in the Constitution, we have foreseen, for example, to open the meetings of the European Council when the European Council is legislating. That was the public meetings. Secondly, we have enlarged in the European Constitution the powers of the European Parliament. In the European Constitution, in the project of European Constitution, there is more co-decision for the European Parliament on a huge number of large range of issues, and certainly there are other things to do. So, but that was not enough explained certainly in the whole debate in the different countries of the European Union, that there were also in this Constitution more possibilities for the people to express themselves. I hope that certainly these elements can come back in the future, opening make the meetings of the Council public, more co-decision between the European Parliament and the European Council, and why not in the future? A directly elected European president.
Thank you. Please sit here at the front.
Seda Chief GCSAS. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for your presentation. As a person who is advocating the United States of Europe, do you see, envision Turkey as a full member in the future, considering there's a huge debate and in some circles, huge reaction against Turkey's membership?
I have already defended the entrance of Turkey in the European Union, and I know there is some hesitation in the public opinion about it. This is very clear. That was maybe also one of the elements that have played a negative role in the outcome of the referenda in France and the Netherlands. And that's also one of the reasons why I'm advocating these two circles. Because until now we have this tension between the idea of deepening the European Union and enlarging the European Union. I think that we can go on both tracks if we have this inner circle, this European Federation, mainly based on the Eurozone, who is deepening his European integration on a number of fields, certainly on the social and economic matters. And then you can easily, if you do that, without any problem with your public opinion, enlarge your European Union to new member states. Bulgaria, Romania, in the short term, I hope also the Balkan countries, because if we want to stabilize the Balkan countries and the whole Balkan region, it's absolutely necessary that we put them the fastest as possible in the European Union. I know there are a number of conditions to fulfill, et cetera, but I think that the interest of the international community and the interest, certainly, of Europe is to put them the fastest as possible in this big democratic family to stabilize this part of the region. And then furthermore, certainly other. I'm looking forward to a European Union that can have 30, maybe 35, I don't know, maybe more member states. But then a European Union that is more an organization of European states, capable and competent for guaranteeing the stability and the peace on the European continent, and then inside this big family, this European federation that is going further, that can be the locomotive of the whole continent.
Terry here. This is from wait for the microphone. Just wait for the microphone. It's just coming.
Apologies. My name is Murphy. I head an international consultancy, but I also am with CSIS, and I had the great pleasure to live in your wonderful country for 4 years. My question, I am a lawyer. My question is about your tribute to our country. I think many of us would appreciate that very much. But when you talked about our Constitution, one of its model, it's quite simple. And the European Constitution that was written was mind-boggling. You couldn't imagine how anybody.
That's the difference between the 18th century and the 21st century.
And so, without
it's true.
Going into all these very important issues,
I agree.
Is there any thought given to simplifying whatever draft comes out next time?
I think I like more constitutional experts of the 18th than of the 21st century. I agree with I agree with you. And certainly, maybe one of the errors that has been made was to try to put everything in this constitution, even the policies of the union. The policies of the union, okay, we could put them in legislation, in directives, in other reglementation. And it was not necessary maybe to put everything as we done in this constitution with his three parts and his different annexes. Nevertheless, this work of the European Constitution was already an enormous simplification with the former treaties that exist. Because we built it up, the Union in 55 in Rome. It was discussed in Brussels, near to Brussels. That was the first. And then we added every intergovernmental conference after intergovernmental conference, new parts to this treaty: Amsterdam, Maastricht, and Nice, the last time. And so a fundamental simplification of all this was necessary. But you can maybe have your right when you say you failed, because normally the constitution is something like that. What do you say? 100 articles maximum in a good constitution. Maybe we failed also in that field. Yeah. I agree.
I think we have time for one more question. There was one waiting here. So there's a question. I know we saw the hand up here. Nope. Okay. I'll take it away. In that case, I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair. In that case, one more time. We haven't talked about your main proposal. I think the one that really has captured the attention most, which is the issue of using the Eurozone countries as the core for a future European Union.
It's not my first choice. Like I said, for me, it can be all 25.
Yep.
But is it not possible with all 25? You have to start somewhere. So why invent new things when they exist? Eurozone exists. Eurogroup exists. It's a closer enhanced cooperation that we are practicing every day. So I'm saying, okay, take then the Eurozone. The Eurozone is an open cooperation. First of all, you have no problems with the two countries who said no, because they are inside the Eurozone. Secondly, it's an open cooperation. So the new member state shall enter. It's very clear that in the next years, well, they fulfill the conditions. Countries like Slovenia, the Baltic states, others, the other new member states, shall enter in the next years in the Eurozone. And those who are not in it, it's not a closed club. It's not a closed shop, I should say.
But, Mr. Prime Minister, isn't there a risk that as it enlarges, if it does, and it's likely to, the kind of countries it enlarges to may not share the same vision of being part of a political union? And they join it perhaps for economic reasons rather than the political aspect.
Okay, but that is the new step forward that we are making. If we follow this guideline in the book, you are creating, in fact, a European Federation with a far more intensified integration and integrated policies than what we have today, not only economically and socially, but also on home affairs. And in the future also, I think, on foreign policies and on defense. And there, on foreign policies and defense, it's quite possible that the Federation is working together with the other parties, naturally, and the other member states of your European Union, because certainly they have some assets that are very important in that field.
Well, I'm conscious that I said 5 to 5 and we're already up at 5 o'clock. Really, thank you very much for proving that a period of reflection can be a truly creative period. And thank you also for coming to CSIS and helping test our own intellectual thought with your ideas.
Thank you
very much.